So, I'm going to take you way back. Can you think about what your earliest memory is?
Yes, my earliest memory would be, I was born in 1944, so my earliest memory would probably be about 1947 or 8, when I was 4 years old. And I had gone to the ponds to get some fish. And I had a jam jar with some string around it, and I had a fishing net, and I had about 15 little minnows in the water, and I was really, really happy. So I brought it back, and I was climbing up the stairs to go into the house to show off my catch, and a girl who lived above me, who sadly was Down syndrome and was a wee bit aggressive, came up the stairs, grabbed the jar, swung it as hard as she could, smashed it against the wall, and all the fish were in a big puddle on the steps, squirming about. And the noise of the glass crashing, mm-hmm. and then all these little minnows squirming in the pond was just too much for me. And I evidently ran off, you know, yelling my head off. And I don't know what happened to her, but then, you know, she couldn't really help it. She wasn't right. Sheila, her name was. And that's one of my earliest memories of...
Is that when you lived in Craigie
That was in Craigie Street, in the tenement. A room in a kitchen. Five of us in that house. Well, there was six, but then my dad died. Five of us in that house. My mum, two brothers and a sister, and myself, and I was the youngest. And the toilet was on the stair. There was no electricity until just before we left that. We had gas lamps. And we left Craigie Street I was seven, so that would have been 1951. We left Craigie Street, and it was just before that they got electric lighting in these houses. The outside was lit by gas lamp, you know, the outside lights in the street and on the stairs. The lamplighter came at night and put the lights on and came in the morning and put them off. There was an actual lamplighter. And he came with a great big long pole that he would, because the gas lamps were really high up to keep them away from the kids. So he came up with a great big long pole, and I don't know how he did it, but he just seemed to stick the pole into the glass, and the light either went on or went off. Mm-hmm. I've never yet discovered what that pole was all about, but that was what he did. So it was a colourful place to live in many ways. And
How old were you when your dad died?
I was just coming up for two when my dad died. He had some injuries in the war, and when he came home from the war, he was most unwell, and he developed tuberculosis, and there was no cure for tuberculosis in these days, so he was put into hospital. And when it became clear that he was going to die, my mum took him out of the hospital. We were all sent out of the house because it was so contagious, tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. So we were put away from the house, you know, ferried out to different people to look after us, and my mum looked after him. And then he died, and the five of us stayed on in the house until, as I say, 1951. And then we were sent out to what, to me, was the country and was a bungalow. And the council had started to decant people from the centre of the city out to the housing schemes, mm-hmm. Which virtually were built in the country. And certainly for us townies, we were surrounded by fields in the housing estate that we were sent to. That was in Fintry.
Right.
In Fintry. And there was three bedrooms. There was a bath, which was a huge luxury. There was a bath and a toilet. And of course, the biggest luxury was that it was indoors. You know, we didn't have to go out to the toilet. And we had a proper kitchen and a living room. and a front and back door and a garden. And that was incredible for I mean, I only had a short experience of my life in a tenement, but for people who were born and bred and brought up in tenements all their lives, to move out to a council house in the country with all these facilities was just amazing. But one of the problems with that was the council were not very long-sighted, because they put people out there, but there was no infrastructure built. The roads weren't completed, so there was no transport could come out there. There was no shops, so it meant that people had to walk into town. Now, it wasn't that far. It wasn't that far, but it did mean a hike into town for shopping. Then they started through time to have some vans come out. You know, a baker van would come out, and a butcher van, and a fish van. But of course, they were expensive. Because they, you know, they had their overheads for their vehicles. So most people trekked into the town, and then gradually shops were built as the schemes developed and got bigger, because we were in the first street that was ever built in Fintry. It's called Fintry Gardens, and that was the first street of this, what is now a huge housing estate. But when when the first street was built, the road wasn't built, the houses were built, and they were complete, but there was no road, you know, so it was a kind of a muddy track up to the house. It sounds incredible because it's all laid out now and everything's, all the roads are complete and there's a huge infrastructure now. There's schools and shops and, you know, clinics and all this kind of thing there now, but there wasn't in these days. But anyway, nevertheless, I thought I had died and gone to heaven because it was just incredible. In fact, I kept running, evidently I kept running through the house. It was such a novelty to go in one door, run through the house and out the other door. It was a huge novelty. And then, like every other novelty, it just became, you know, it just wore off and it was just your house and that was fine. But,
Were you at school age?
Yeah, well, there's another story with that. My mum, I had gone to the school, Glebelands, which was near to Craigie Street. And so when I moved out to the housing scheme, my mother took me to the window and pointed to the wee school that was in the field, a few fields away. There was a wee school in the field. And she said to me, "See that building there?" And I said, "Yeah." She says, "That's the school you're going to tomorrow." And of course, I did my usual, you know, "I don't want to go to that school because, you know, I've got all my friends are at Glebelands. I don't want to go there." "Oh, well, you've no choice. That's where you're going." And the next day, she took me down to the corner of the street. And two girls, one was called Ruth Gold and one was called Dorothy Wright. I remember them so clearly. And she said to them, "You going down to that school?" And they said, "Yes," and said, "Well, take her with you." That's true. Now, they would be maybe a year older than me. Mm-hmm. You know, they're bigger than me. But they took me to the school and they took me into the headmaster and said, "This is a new girl. She's starting here today." So he said, "You know, what's your name?" Gave him my name. And he said, "Go along to room 4. And I just had to walk along the corridor and go into room 4. And the teacher there said, "Just come in." She'd looked at the register. She was obviously expecting me. Looked at the register and said, "Just sit down there." And my worry was that on the blackboard, they were doing joined up writing. And she said to the class, "Now I want you to copy this passage into your jotter." And she handed me a split new jotter and a split new pencil. And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, but I don't do that kind of writing." And she said, "Well, you do now. That's the kind of writing we do here." So having gone from just, you know, I don't know what you call the not joined, the unjoined up writing, to the joined up writing, shifted from that in a matter of a morning, and then came home and was shown off that I could now write in big people's writing. You know, big people, that was the way big people wrote. So that was my jot. And I was very pleased with that. I was worried to begin with, but yeah, I was very pleased with that. And I loved that school. I actually loved that school. It's called Linlathen Primary. And One of my teachers was a lady called Eleanor Leith, that we of course called Miss Leith, and but she told us her name was Eleanor, and I was a bit of a mischief, but she seemed to like me. And one day I had a sore tooth, and because I mean, we didn't have a dentist or anything. God, I don't think I had a toothbrush in these days, never mind a dentist. But anyway, she said, "What's wrong with you?" Because I'd maybe been mumping and sulking because I was in pain with this tooth. And I told her I had a sore tooth, and she says, "Well, get your mummy to take you to the dentist." And I said, "Well, my mum doesn't have time to do that, you see, because, you know, I mean, we don't know where the dentist is and all this nonsense." So she said, "Well, I'll tell you what," she said, "I'll take you to a dentist." And at 4 o'clock, I got to sit in her car. That was a huge excitement. I got to sit in her car, and she took me to this dentist down in Stobswell. We went in, we went up the stairs. It was up a stair. Went up the stairs. It was a bit scary because I'd never been in a dentist, and all the instruments were there and everything. But the great thing was, on the radio, which was in the surgery bit, he had Scottish music playing, and all the time the music was playing, he was singing along to it. You know, I mean, it was amazing. And he sat me in the chair and gave me a swirl around, let it swirl around a wee bit. He knew I was frightened. And Miss Leith just popped her head in and then popped her head out again. And he did whatever he did to the tooth. I don't even know whether he pulled it out or whether he filled it. That I can't remember. But he looked after the tooth anyway. And he gave me a little round tin of toothpaste and a tiny little brush. He just gave it to me to take home. And he said, because he said, do you brush your teeth often? And I said, no. I didn't have a toothbrush or toothpaste. So he gave me the toothpaste and the toothbrush. And he said, "Now, when you go home, you need to brush your teeth in the morning before you go to school and at night before you go to bed." And he said, "You have very good teeth, but you want to keep them. Keep them good. Do you eat many sweeties?" And I said, "No," because we didn't get sweeties. But for some reason, my teeth had gone a bit bad. So that was that. And it was the next day at school, and Miss Leith ran me back to where I lived. And by that time now, we were in a prefab. And so she ran me back to the house, or to the street where I lived anyway, and I jumped out the car. And she said to me, "Did you notice the name on the dentist's? Did you notice the name on the plaque outside?" And I said, "No. I never even noticed the plaque, never mind the name." And she said, "Well, the name says Gordon S. Leith, dental surgeon. And Gordon S. Leith is my father." And I says, "Oh, your father's a dentist." And she said, "Yes." She said, "So." Now, I went to that dentist for years after that. You know, went every 6 months or whatever it was, you know, for your checkups. And kept up, you know, with the dentist for many, many years after that, until I went to Mr. Butt, that you went to.
The first dentist I can remember.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Leith died, because he was a good age when, you know, he was quite elderly. Mm-hmm. When I went with that night with Miss Leith, so he was a good age, and he died, and then I didn't have a dentist for a wee while, and then I started going to Mr. Butt, and then he was the lifelong dentist after mm-hmm. that, and looked after you folks' teeth as well. But, yeah, I loved that school. That was a great school. She was a really, really nice person, Miss Leith. And she used to give us all a Christmas present. Everybody the whole class got a Christmas present. Now, it was just a small thing, you know, maybe a penny dainty or something like that. But the great thing was that you got called out of your desk. You got called out of your seat to come and get it. Mm-hmm. And you felt so important, you know. And she always kept me to last. I was always last because I was, alphabetically, I was last, with nobody behind me alphabetically, because I was T for Tate. Mm-hmm. And I was always last. And the anticipation, because it was always in a little brown paper bag. Mm-hmm. So you didn't know what you were going to get. And everybody got something a wee bit different. And, the anticipation of that was amazing. And then you would go out and you'd say something like, "Well, I hope you have a very nice Christmas, and we'll take care on the roads, and we'll see you after the after the holiday. You know, she always said that every year. We had her for 2-3 years, I think. So she sticks in my memory as far as teachers are concerned, because she was so kind. And she was really kind as well to all the naughty ones. You know how, you know, including myself, you had these naughty people. And she was the one as well, when she'd said, I was misbehaving one day, and she said to me, right, get out. She said, I can't remember, did she say outside? No, yes, she said out. And I didn't know whether she meant out the class or out the school, out of Dundee or out of everything. So I thought, well, if you stand outside the door and the headmaster comes along, you get into trouble because he knows you've been put out for being naughty. So I thought, well, the only thing to do is go home. And I went right out of the school. And the thing was, I knew that if I got home, once I got home, there would be nobody in. I would be stuck because my mum was working, Olive was at school. My brother was home on leave from the army, but I wasn't very sure about that, whether he would be home. Anyway, it was a winter's day, a dark day, and when I came up to near the prefab, I could see the light on in the bathroom. So I knew he was in. So I went in, and he said to me, why are you home? You should be at school. And I first of all said I was sick, and I wasn't feeling well, I was feeling sick. So that was first of all. I thought I'd try that tack. And he said to me, this is Neil, and he said to me, you don't look sick. And I said, I've really got a really sore tummy. And eventually it came out that I'd been put out, because I was wanting to ask him whether she meant out forever or just out. So he said, well, if you've been naughty, I think you've probably been told to get out of the classroom, not out of the whole school, and certainly not out of education, the education system. So he said, now you know what you have to do? And I said, no. He says, well, you have to go right back after lunchtime, and you have to stand at her desk. When the school bell rings, you line up, then you go to her, you get into school, get into the classroom, go to her desk and say, Miss Leith, I'm really sorry for misbehaving this morning, and I won't do it again. And I said, well, no, see, I can't do that because everybody will laugh. And he says, well, that's why you have to do it. That's why you've got to say you're really sorry and you won't do it again. And I was going back down the road saying, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. I'm just going to sit in the classroom. I'm not saying anything. I'm just going to go in, go to my desk and sit down. And I went into the classroom, and I don't know why I did this. I don't know why I did it to this day. But I sort of sidled up to the desk, and she was trying not to look at me. She could see me at the corner of her eye, but she was trying not to look at me. Eventually she turned around and she said, yes. And I said what Neil said for me to say, with great difficulty, but I said it. And she just said one word, sit. And so I just turned from the desk and sat. But then I was happy because I thought, I'm back in again. You know, I wasn't quite sure how things were going to go if I was out forever. Mm-hmm. You know, how was I going to learn things, or when could I play in the playground if I wasn't at the school, you know. So I was happy to be back in that school system again.
You were quite known for that kind of thing, though, weren't you? Because there was the time at nursery as well that you just sort of went AWOL.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was actually AWOL from school because, you see, I was brought up in the nursery. And I was in the nursery when I was months old because my mum had to go to work. And there was all these council nurseries where babies were taken in because it was just after the war and, you know, things were very, very different. And anyway, I was brought up in Ellangown Nursery. Every day I went there. And I was virtually just taken home at night and put to bed. So the nursery was my home. The nursery was really like my home. And when I went to school, I went to school the first day, went, you know, was taken in, registered and everything. And at playtime, when we came out to play, I just walked out the school and walked back to the nursery, which was within walking distance of the school. I just went right back to the nursery because I thought, well, it's time to go home now. I've had enough of that. And then I'd evidently appeared at a window. They had very low windows in this nursery school. The windows were deliberately low. You know, the windows actually came down quite low so that the nurses could see out if the children were playing out. But I had looked in the window of the matron of the nursery school, and she was sitting at her desk writing, and she looked up and she said, evidently she said to my mum, all she could see was this head of blonde curls looking in the window and thinking, oh God, she's back. She's gone, oh God, we've got her back. So she beckoned to me to come in. So when I went into her room, she said to me, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I just came back because I've been to school now and it was okay, but that's it. And she said, no, no, you don't come back here, Audrey. You have to stay at school. You're at school now. You don't come to nursery school. And she phoned the school and said, you'll have to send her sister along for her. Now, Olive was in a few primaries above me. You'll have to send her sister for her. So Olive came for me, dragging me along the road because she was fed up. She'd been taken out of a class that she was really enjoying, maybe art or something, and she had to come and collect me, so she took me back. Now, after that, I think I was the start of them locking gates and things in schools, because they didn't lock the gate. I just walked out of the gate. And I never actually did go back to the nursery school, but I was really sad, you know, because it really was my life, the nursery school. It was my home for all these years. And the nurses were like mums, really, you know, the nursery nurses were all, because you were taken there. Like my mum started in the mills at, she would probably start at 7:30, 7:45, so I'd be taken there at the back of 7, just after 7. And then I wouldn't be picked up until 5:30, 5:45 at night. And then, of course, you know, my mum would be tired, so we would be taken home and bathed, or maybe not even bathed, just taken home and put to bed, really. So that's why it was important that the nursery, that's why the nursery school was so important to me.
And what was your granny doing? Was she also working in the mills when you were that age?
Yeah, you see, there was nobody to look after you because everybody, you know, my mum's sisters and brothers were all in the mill, and they all did a different job. And my mum was a spool winder, which just is exactly what it says. She wound the flax onto the spools. Mm-hmm. And there was one of my other aunts was a weaver, and there was a finisher, and there was a flattener, and there was a sparker, and oh, there was all the different trades. Mm-hmm. of the jute industry, and they all worked in different parts of it. You know, my mum said at one stage there was a member of the family in every sector of the mill, right at the beginning, and then because the flax goes through different processes, you know, arrived off the ships from Pakistan, and then it went through various processes. And my mum reckoned that at one stage, you know, the family had all grown up, and at one stage there was one of them in each area of the mill.
How many siblings did Nana have?
She was the oldest of 13. Right. She had 12 brothers and sisters. Mm-hmm. There was 6 girls and 7 boys. Mm-hmm. 6 girls and 7 boys. Twins, Joseph and James. They died in infancy. They were about 4 months old, evidently, when they died. But that was common long ago, sadly, because that was before inoculations, and that's when things were, people with that size of a family certainly couldn't afford to nourish them all. You know, they wouldn't be all well nourished, I wouldn't have thought. And they lived a very hard life in a very, very small house in the centre of the town, near the docks. And my mum, being the oldest, had a lot of work to do, you know, besides her job. She had a lot of work to do in the house with the children. And it doesn't sound like a great life at all. It wasn't a good life.
What about your mum's dad? Was he...
My mum's dad... Yeah, he was called Joseph, and he was a bit of a dead loss, really, as my mum would put it, because he drank very heavily, and he worked on the docks. He was a plater, and that was a skill that was to do with shipbuilding. Plating was to do with, you know, putting the outside pieces on the actual ship. And so that's what my grandfather did, but very often he was never at his work because he couldn't lift his head off the pillow if he was really drunk. But my granny used to be able to go down and get his wages.
Right.
Yeah, she would go to the docks. And they knew what my grandfather was like. And they knew that she had this huge family. And she used to get his wages. She just picked up his wages. He didn't touch his wages. Mm-hmm. She said he always got money somewhere for drinks. She's never yet really knew where he got it from. Mm-hmm. But he always managed to get money for drink. Mm-hmm. So she had a very hard life, extremely hard life. And yet she was very tough, very resilient. I mean, she was in her 80s and she was still helping, you know, washing nappies for her various, you know, grandchildren and whatever else. So she was really a bit of a character.
That's the one that thought I was a boy, wasn't
she? Yes, yes. She couldn't get around your name, Keris. She couldn't... I mean, Keris, that was... she'd never heard of it, of course, but then it sounded really like a boy, so she couldn't cope with that at all. But, yeah, I think they had a really, really hard time. And when my mum was expecting me, this just gives you an idea of the sort of the culture of the time. When my mum was expecting me, her mum, who was my gran, had gone to the pictures. They'd gone to see a film. And they were sitting in the pictures, and my mum, you know, her due date was a few weeks away, but she started to feel really uncomfortable in the pictures, and she'd said to my gran, I'm really not feeling too good. So my gran said, oh, well, she listened to her saying that for a wee while, and eventually she said, oh, come on, we'll walk up the road. So they started to walk up the road, and walking up the road was becoming more and more uncomfortable for my mum. It wasn't that far, but it was up a hill, and she really was uncomfortable. Anyway, they got up to the circle round about where my granny lived, because we were going back to my granny's, and several of my mum's brothers were hanging about on the corner, as they did in these days. So my granny says, you better go down for the midwife. And my mum had definitely said, oh, I don't think I'm needing a midwife. She said, I think I've still got a bit to go yet, but she said, I'm really uncomfortable. And my granny said to Thomas, go and get the midwife. So Thomas took his heels and ran down through Midcraigie to find the midwife, by which time, my mum and my gran had got home, and my gran said to my mum, well, you better go through and lie down, because she had been looking a bit white and poorly. So she went through to lie down, and I came into the world. And my gran said, the midwife arrived, and my gran had just said, too late, you know, she's... the baby's born. So my gran virtually brought me into the world. So that was, you know, that was that. And evidently my gran had bought quite a few people, you know, a few of the neighbours that had gone into labour too quick. You know, the midwives didn't get there in time. My gran thought nothing of it. Well, I mean, she'd had 13 of her own.
Yeah.
She knew fine. She maybe delivered some of them. She knew fine what to do and so on. So, I mean, it was quite nice because she used to tell me years later that, you know, she had brought me into the world, and fortunately it was quite an easy birth. You know, there was no complication. I'm sure if there's complications, then they have to get into hospital. But most babies in these days were born at home. And you only went to hospital to have your baby in these days if there was a complication. Most infants were born at home. So my granny certainly brought me into the world.
And was it common? Was it common for men to be around?
No.
In these days?
No. Oh no, it wasn't common for men to be around when you were born, Keris. Mm. Some men did it. Some men chose to do it, but it wasn't common. And I think a lot of it. I don't even think it was so much the men didn't want to be there. The hospital didn't want them there. It was. They've changed. You see, that's all changed now. The hospital, and I think it's changed for the better, the hospital recognises that mums want the dad there, want their husbands there in some cases, but in certainly in my mum's day, oh my god, my dad was at sea, you know, he was in the Navy and he was away with the war, but I would have doubted if he would have been there, and none of the boys were allowed in the room, you know, none of the brothers or certainly my brothers were allowed into the room. So yeah, it was very, very different in these days. But I think my mum, by the time I came along, had probably just had enough babies. You know, she'd have practically brought up all her own siblings, and then she had four of her own. So I think she'd just well had enough by that time.
Yeah, and she lost her husband.
That's right. So, I mean, it was hard. It was hard for her. There's no doubt about it. But, it just seemed that long ago, but and yet in some ways it's a million light years from nowadays, you know, how things have changed, and some things have definitely changed for the better, but I still think some things were better in our day, in that, you know, we could play in the street. There's no cars. I mean, cars never came along our street. I wasn't in a car until I was about seven. And the only reason I was in a car was because I was a flower girl at our next door neighbour's wedding, and Olive and I got to sit in a car, and we thought that was amazing. And I got gloves. That was another amazing thing. I didn't worry. I was like you when you were little girls. You never liked dresses and things. Neither did I. And the only way I would wear the dress was I had gloves. I got to wear these gloves, and I remember my mum saying, I mean, it's ridiculous, you know, she doesn't like wearing a dress, but she's happy to wear the gloves. So for some reason we had these little white, wrist gloves, and I thought I was really something in these gloves. And,
So do you think it was much safer then for children, or do you think it's just that we hear more about what goes on now?
I think it was generally safer, and yet I was taken away from the street, but we won't go into that. But I think it was generally safer, and the reason for that is that an awful lot of the neighbours hung around the street. There was more community spirit, I think, then. And that might be just because even of the layout of the houses, I don't know. But there seemed to, in our street, there was two shops on the end of the street. You know, there was a greengrocer and a grocer, like a fruit shop and a grocer. And the ladies of the street, certainly the elderly ladies of the street, used to sit on the shop windowsills and, you know, share their snuff boxes and chatter away of an evening. You know, there was always somebody in the street. So, of course, when kids were playing, you know, if they fell over or they were unwell or they were fighting something, these elderly ladies were unwittingly babysitters, you know, because they'd say, hey, stop that, or, you know, they would get involved in some fracas if anything was happening. And I think that culture has gone. I think that culture's gone because people are, well, I think it might have just been the layout of the buildings and everything. I'm not sure. And the fact that there was no traffic came along the street. There was no buses, you see, in these days. It was tram cars. And the tram cars came down the main street because of the cable line. So the street really was a playground. The street was the playground. And we had park. We had Baxter Park. But then you couldn't go up to Baxter Park unless somebody took you there, you know, because it was a fair wee step for us. But the boys, you know, my brothers, they played in the street. They played football in the street. And there was air raid shelters around the back in our close, you know, for the war. And, of course, they weren't taken down even after the war finished. So the best thing in the world was to climb on the top of them. And they would be maybe 9-10 feet high. You know, they weren't that high, but high when you're wee. And, of course, you weren't allowed on them. There was a big rule, and kids weren't allowed on the top. They liked to go in them, but they weren't allowed to go on the top of them. And there were all manner of wee sort of wooden ladders and things, and wee sort of piles of stones that would be erected to get you up onto the top. And they were all hidden round from the windows, hidden round the back, so that your mum, if she looked out, she couldn't see you climbing onto the shelter. And you never climbed on a shelter, of course, that was within sight of your own window. Everybody went to another shelter. And there was one day that Olive and I were, you know, they'd got me up onto the shelter. I was only about three, seemingly. And they'd got me up onto this shelter. And I mean, we just felt we were so mischievous and being so daredevilish, you know, on the top of the shelter. And I can remember actually being a bit wimpy and thinking, oh, you know, it seemed so high once I got up there. I thought, oh. And then the next thing was the policeman came through the big pen, and all we could see was the top of his helmet. And all of a sudden, says to me, lie flat on your face and don't say a word. So I'm spread-eagled on the top of the shelter. And little did we know that this guy could just stand on the pile of stones that we got up on. And then we could see his whole head looking across. And all he did, he was a great big man, and all he did was put over his massive hand, pluck me off of this shelter and, you know, lift me down, but drop me about a foot from the bombs so that I didn't get down with too much ease. And then he licked his pencil, sheafed through his notebook to get to the right page, and then he said, name. So, of course, your name went in the policeman's book, and the idea now was the policeman was going to go to your door and tell your mum you'd been on the shelters. So Olive and I decided we were actually going to have to run away. We could not go home because the punishment would fit the crime, and the crime was bad and the punishment would be worse. So we thought, well, we'll just make a run for it. So we went out the close and we got along to the end of the street, and Olive just kept saying to me, just keep following me, just keep following me. And then we looked up the street and all we could see was my gran coming down Albert Street, bustling as she did. You know, she always came down, so she was on a mission. She came down and she shouts to Olive, you, come here. So, of course, she'd seen the two of us, you see. So Olive goes up, what are you doing? What are you doing on the end of the street? We weren't supposed to be on the end of the street, so you're all supposed to be in the middle of the street. So Olive said, we're just looking for somebody. She said, well, get. And that meant, get meant get home. So we just turned tail and went back, and we sort of sat outside for a while thinking, well, has he been yet? Has he been to the door yet? Or will he go after? Because we thought, well, we need to go, we need to get some tea sometime. So we weren't sure whether we should go and have the tea and then get the belting, or we should just not go. But I've got this story in my head and I'm not just sure what happened, but certainly we never got into trouble. So I don't think the guy ever went near the door. I don't think the policeman did. But on saying that, we never went on the shelters again because we just got such a fright that if my mum, like if a policeman went to your door, I mean, that was the end of the world, you know.
Can you remember rations, mum? Did you still have rations?
Mm-hmm. Had ration books right up until, we didn't have ration books in Fintry, so I would imagine, I think 1948, or 48, 49 would be the end of the rationing, I think. And that's why we'd never had any sweeties, because you did get coupons for sweeties, but you could swap them for coupons for an egg, this kind of thing. And of course, I mean, sweeties were for rich children, you know. So we never, ever got sweeties. I can remember getting an Easter egg when I was quite big, when I say that, maybe 8 or 9, from my Uncle John, bought Olive and I an Easter egg. And, I mean, you just thought, oh, your birthdays would come together. An Easter egg to yourself. And we were in Woolworths, and the woman went to put mine in a bag. You know, put it in a bag, and I didn't want it in a bag because I had to show it off. I wanted everybody in the world to see this Easter egg and really show it off that it was mine. And of course, my mum confiscated the Easter egg as soon as we got home. The Easter egg was put into the cupboard, and we were only allowed a tiny little bit every day. And she was allowed a tiny little bit of our Easter egg every day. So with the result, that Easter egg lasted. Seemed to last forever. But we just, and I mean, you couldn't steal it. You know, you couldn't, I mean, that did occur to us. We thought, we could go and steal a bit more. But she knew what stage that Easter egg was at. So you could not steal it. And I reckon, I've got a theory on this, because I reckon that's why we all had good teeth. You know, we never had a blooming toothbrush, but then we never had sweeties, and we didn't have biscuits. You know, you didn't have a lot of sweet things. Didn't have really a lot of anything, but you certainly didn't have a lot of sweet things. But yeah, I've got a lot of happy memories. I don't have memories, sadly, of like ever getting on my mum's knee or getting a story. Or I mean, we didn't have any storybooks. Or I loved going to the little story classes in the library. There's little storytelling classes where you could, primaries 1, 2 and 3, got allowed to go to the library, and a lady would come and read a story to you, and that was great. I loved that, because this lady would make all the characters come to life. You know, she would speak like the character did, and I always thought that was really clever. Because she became that character in the book, you know. But after you came out of primary 3, that was it. You know, you never got another story in your life again. That was the end of the stories. So I don't have memories of that kind of home life, but I have happy memories of situations and incidents at school and outside of home life, you know. I have that.
When did you start going skating?
Yeah, skating. I started to go when I was probably in secondary school, 12. Yeah, started going when I was 12. Started to try and learn to skate. That was a laugh, because you know you spent more time on the ice than you did on your feet. But eventually, you know, after years of plodding on, became quite a good skater. Certainly quite a good speed skater. Used to like to go up at the what they call the ladies' speed. And, you know, the ladies would go around as fast as they could, and then there was the men's speed, then there was the dancing. Now, I wasn't good enough for that, but...
dancing?
Yeah, they danced on ice, yeah. Maureen Golden, I remember Maureen Golden. The first time I ever saw her, was on the ice. And it was only after I met up with her years later, I said to her, I recognise you. You used to be an ice skater, ice dance skater, didn't you? And she said, yeah. She had the most beautiful costumes, I remember. She always had different costumes on, and she was very, very good. She was a great ice dance skater, and I used to love watching it. At that time, most people just went away and had a cup of tea or a drink of juice when these intervals were on, but I always stayed. I always just liked to watch them. And a few couples would go and do the dancing together. It really was good. But, I liked skating.
And what did you wear when you went?
Did skating? Well, I got a pair of, I thought it was really something. I got a pair of wine, burgundy, corduroy trousers and a white polo neck jumper. And that was really trendy in these days. That was really trendy. And then I can remember I had a skating skirt. Because girls wore skating skirts in these days. And I can remember just not liking it because I thought it was too long. And I said to Olive, you know, my sister, could you shorten that for me? You know, Mrs. can't do anything for herself, said. Could you shorten that for me? And so she starts to pin it up a bit, you see. And I said, no, I want it shorter than that. And she was saying... you can't get it any shorter than that, for goodness sake. And I think it was Neil. Neil came in and, you know, came in on all this nonsense and me saying, I want it shorter than that. And he said, no, you don't. He said, that's a good length the way that is just now. And he said, always remember, it's what people don't see that's more interesting, not what they see. And I've never forgotten that. So anyway, I got my skirt at the decent length. And that was that. But we didn't wear skirts too long, and then it was mostly trousers. It was mostly trousers because it was cold, you know. And if you went down with a skating skirt on, you know, you were soaking, you know. But your trousers gave you a wee bit more protection, and it was great fun. I loved the skate. That's where I met my first boyfriend, Bill Heron. That's where I met him. But he really fancied my friend. He fancied my friend Carol Rains. So it was really after things just went sour with him and Carol. I had to wait in line. And then after things went really sad with him and Carol, he started to skate around with me. That was what you did. The boys came and sort of skated alongside you. when I think back. And he offered me a piece of his chewing gum. That was quite serious. That was it. That was serious. I thought he was probably, the next question would be wanting to marry me. That wasn't the next question. The next question was, how far do you live from the ice rink? That was before he said, can I walk you home? So you had to wait and see how far it was, and was it in his direction now? And fortunately, it was kind of in his direction. So Bill and I sort of skated around together, went for wee walks. You know, I was maybe about 13, 14 at this time. Went for wee walks on a Sunday around Caird Park and scintillating stuff. And I liked he had a lovely little sister, I remember. There was Bill, and then there was this huge gap, you know, and then his mum had this unexpected little baby, you know, a little girl. And she, I remember her, I just thought she was gorgeous, like a wee Shirley Temple, only blonde. And sometimes he used to come with her, and we would take her to the park and stuff like that. And then we just sort of drifted, you know, we just drifted away. But it was certainly the skating that the first boyfriend was was on the cards. But yeah, skating was really good fun. And again, it was dead safe because we used to come out the skating and walk all the way home, you know, along the Kingsway, all the way home. And that was a long way. That was quite a long way. But there was never, I don't remember any trouble or anybody being attacked or assaulted or mugged or anything like that. You know, it seemed to be dead safe. Yeah, it was good. You liked the skating too, didn't you? Yeah.